Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. We'll begin with the entrance today into the Democratic race for the 2020 presidency by Senator Kamala Harris, the junior senator from California, and speak with Lara Bazelon, a professor of law at the University of San Francisco School of Law and the author of Rectify, The Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction. She joins us to discuss her article at the New York Times, Kamala Harris Was Not a Progressive Prosecutor, and examine the record of Kamala Harris as a district attorney in San Francisco and as Attorney General of California. We'll look into some of the cases she oversaw, which indicate she took a very hard line as a prosecutor, and explore whether that will help her with potential conservative voters or alienate potential liberal voters. And also note some of the positive moves she made in diverting first-time offenders into vocational training programs, mandating bias training, and correcting the backlog in the testing of rape kits. Then, although she has only been in the Senate for 2 years, we will assess whether Kamala Harris's feisty style of aggressive questioning of Sessions and Kavanaugh will serve her well with the Democratic base, who are looking for a fighter to take on Donald Trump. Then on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we will speak with Kristen Clark, President and Executive Director of the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, and investigate whether the new conservative majority on the Supreme Court will undo the legacy of MLK by doing what the Roberts Court did to the Voting Rights Act, which is to declare the need for racial justice as outdated racial entitlements. We'll explore whether the new Kavanaugh Court will use this same tactic to weaken the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and the Fair Housing Act of 1968. Then finally, we'll examine the mounting evidence that President Trump's perverse foreign policy of cozying up to despots while trashing allies is so brazen in its blindness to Russian malign activity that the Congress will have to find a way to stop Trump from pulling out of NATO. Alex Whiting, a professor of practice at Harvard Law School, who is the editor of Just Security, joins us to discuss Trump's ongoing record of consistently blocking congressional efforts to sanction Putin. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Lara Bazelon, who's a professor of law at the University of San Francisco School of Law and a contributor to Slate and Politico and the author of Rectify, The Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction. And she has an op-ed at the New York Times, Kamala Harris Was Not a Progressive Prosecutor. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lara Bazelon.
Thank you for having me.
And today, Senator Kamala Harris of California entered the 2020 presidential contest, making her announcement on ABC's Good Morning America. And first of all, Lara, there's obviously going to be a big field, which will eventually be winnowed away. And my sense is that I'm not entirely sure that all of these 20-odd Democrats are necessarily running for president. Some of them might be running for vice president, like, for example, Julian Castro. What's your sense of whether this freshman senator who's only been in the Senate for 2 years does have a serious chance, shall we say?
I think she is dead serious on running, and I think she has a solid, viable chance.
And what you've revealed in your New York Times piece, I mean, you recall when Bill Clinton ran, he ran as a different kind of a Democrat, and one of the first things he did, was signed a death warrant on executing somebody down in Arkansas to show that he was tough on crime. If her record, and it's mixed, but what you've revealed is pretty alarming, and I want to talk to you about it, obviously. But if she has a tough law and order record, but she's a liberal, the theory would be, going back to Clinton, that the idea is that, you a liberal from California, you're reaching out to the more conservative Americans saying that, you're tough on crime. You're not just a typical liberal. So who is she going to reach out to? I mean, I don't think anybody in the country, in Trump's America, is that going to be that interested in somebody, and they're not going to gravitate to her because she's tough on crime, are they?
I don't think so. Just going back to what you said initially, it does seem a little bit like the Clinton playbook with a twist. So you're absolutely right that Bill Clinton positioned himself as tough on crime, and one of the first things he did was sign the death warrant for someone who is incompetent, as it turns out now, to be executed. And we are suffering under some of the criminal justice policies that he put in place to this day that have contributed to mass incarceration. I think the difference is that Kamala Harris's record in California, from the time that she was district attorney in 2004 until she left office when she was AG to run for the Senate, we've come to a different climate. And now there's just a growing recognition on all sides of the aisle, conservative and liberal, that mass incarceration does no one any good and that these tough on crime policies need to be rescinded and rolled back. And that's the predicament that she finds herself in, because when she was running as DA and running as AG, those positions helped her get elected, and most crucially, they helped her get the support of police officer unions and district attorney associations, which were absolutely vital to her chances. But now those very same positions are seen, rightly, I believe, as regressive. And I think she's going to have a lot of trouble answering for many of the decisions that she made.
And already the field is Elizabeth Warren, Kirsten Gillibrand. We're expecting Cory Booker, Sherrod Brown, Amy Klobuchar, Castro, I mentioned. A lot of talk about Beto and, of course, Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden. So given that some of them are already out there in Iowa, do you think Kamala Harris's strategy would be to concentrate on South Carolina?
I think that, like any viable candidate, she's going to have to turn the majority of her attention to Iowa and New Hampshire, because those states go first. And as Barack Obama's victory showed, it's absolutely crucial to have a strong showing in a state like Iowa. So I think waiting for South Carolina probably tactically is a mistake. I think here's the issue for her that isn't the same issue for the other candidates that you've mentioned. They didn't spend their entire careers as prosecutors. She has to run on that record. And the folks that you're talking about are running on different records than she is. And so they're not going to be in the spotlight and in the crosshairs with respect to criminal justice issues in the same way that she is.
So when it's said that she's a protege of Willie Brown, the famous California legislator, what does that mean? What was the relationship with her and Willie Brown, who's been described as her mentor?
Right. I mean, I think that they were very close, and I think he was incredibly helpful in helping her forge a path toward election, particularly in the race for San Francisco district attorney. As you point out, he was the mayor, very popular, extremely well-connected person, although it's interesting that I do think they have put some distance between each other since that time.
Really? What, any public falling out or anything you can report?
No, there's nothing that I know of other than I just think that she doesn't refer to him so much as she used to in the past.
I see. Again, I'm speaking with Lara Bazelon, who's a professor of law at the University of San Francisco School of Law, a contributor to Slate and Politico, and the author of Rectify, The Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction. And she has an op-ed at the New York Times, Kamala Harris Was Not a Progressive Prosecutor. So let's get into what you've written in your article, Lara. And as I mentioned, her record is mixed, but the story of George Gage is particularly alarming. And George Gage was an electrician with no criminal record. He was charged in 1999 with sexually abusing his stepdaughter, who reported the allegations years later. The case largely hinged on the stepdaughter's testimony, and Mr. Gage was convicted. The stepdaughter, according to her own mother and others' medical reports, indicated that she was a pathological liar. But nevertheless, George Gage, even though he could have basically, my understanding is the whole case could have been thrown out, but Kamala Harris decided she wasn't going to budge with these appeals, upheld the conviction, and Mr. Gage is in prison. He's serving a 70-year sentence. So fill us in on that. I've sketched the broad picture, but what happened there?
I want to start by encouraging your listeners, if they're curious, to Google Gage versus Chappelle oral argument, and they can watch the Ninth Circuit oral argument in the case. It's only a half an hour, and I think it's riveting even for non-lawyers. But what happened is essentially what you said, that there was a ream of evidence showing that the witness, Marion, was not truthful, including a notation in her mother's own handwriting on a hospital intake form describing Marion as, quote, a pathological liar, and she lives her lies. The prosecutor, who's now a judge, didn't turn any of that information over. It came to light when he sought the maximum punishment at sentencing, and the judge specifically asked for it. The judge then reviewed it and had a very strong reaction to it and summarized it in an order granting George Gage a new trial, essentially saying, she said the quote was that Marion was, quote, deranged. And then she talked about the history of untruthfulness and how contrived the testimony was. And then on appeal in the state court, it was reversed on the grounds that, ironically, the judge was relying on evidence that the jury had never heard. So in other words, the prosecutor benefited from his misconduct. By keeping it away, he stopped it from being the grounds for an appeal. And that decision was upheld through the state court system. Then Gage went to federal court, but the problem is at that point, he was not entitled to a lawyer. He's partially blind, had lost all hope, was elderly, and did it on his own. And he failed to raise the claim in exactly the right way, which you have to do by the time you're in that process because of what the law requires. And so in the Ninth Circuit at this oral argument, what Kamala Harris's deputy was arguing over and over and over again was he didn't follow the rules, he didn't dot his I's and cross his T's. And what the Ninth Circuit judges kept saying is, you keep referring to these procedural obstacles, aren't you concerned about this violation of his constitutional rights? And at the end of the argument, the judges basically conceded that because the law was so rigid, Harris's deputy was right on the technical point, but they referred the case to mediation, which is extraordinary and to me signaled that they really wanted Harris to dismiss it, which she had the power to do. As the attorney general, she could have asked the court to vacate the conviction in the interest of justice. And rather than do that, she refused to negotiate. And as you said, George Gage is now going to die in prison. He is 80 years old.
And where can people see this oral argument before the Ninth Circuit?
It's on YouTube because the Ninth Circuit streams all of its oral arguments. So you just go on YouTube and the last name of the other side is Chappelle, Chappell. And it's George Gage. And you just Google that and the argument comes up. You click on it and you can watch it.
And some of the other criticisms that you brought out in your article, Laura, refusing to support a statewide standard regulating the use of body-worn cameras by police. Give us any more details on that.
So this one was particularly troubling for a couple of reasons. One, it happened relatively recently. So it was during her last year as Attorney General in 2016. And it really just provoked the ire of a spectrum of folks because this was at a time, and we still are in a time, of unarmed Black men being shot and killed by police and very little accountability, at least in the eyes of many people, for this issue. And so a coalition of activists, including members of the State Senate Black Caucus and including other activists in the community, had been urging and really hoping her to support that she would support legislation mandating body cameras and also support legislation directing her office to conduct investigations of these shootings. And that, to me, is particularly important because what you have are the local DAs conducting the investigations. And because they're so close with the police, it can be hard for them to be objective, which is why having the state attorney general step in and do a very neutral investigation is so critical. And when she refused to support either bill, there was a lot of outcry in the Bay Area community.
And another case is Daniel Larson. What happened there?
In this case, Mr. Larson was convicted of a crime involving a knife. And because he had two prior convictions under California's three strikes law, he got 28 years to life. And as it turned out, he was innocent. And he was able to show that by, first of all, explaining that his lawyer fell down on the job, didn't call witnesses who clearly saw who the actual perpetrator was, and also by showing that the police officers who testified against him were not credible. And Kamala Harris's office, again, fought tooth and nail. There was a federal magistrate judge who found that Daniel Larsen was innocent, which is an extraordinary finding. And they appealed it. And the basis for appealing wasn't that he wasn't innocent. It was that he had waited too long to raise these claims.
So Kamala Harris's book came out, I think, on the 8th of this month, The Truths We Hold. Anything in her memoir that deals with these cases that you've brought up in your New York Times op-ed?
No, they are absent from the book. What is present in the book and what prompted me to write the op-ed for the New York Times is a chapter devoted to her record as a prosecutor, and she describes herself as, quote, a progressive prosecutor. And when I read those words, I felt a sense of, to be honest, outrage, because she's not a progressive prosecutor. There are many, many examples of progressive prosecutors who are running and winning races all over the United States, and she's just not in that group.
So just give us a definition of a progressive prosecutor.
So there are so many examples to choose from, but there's Kim Fox in Chicago, who has conceded error in, I think, double-digit numbers of wrongful conviction cases. There is Larry Krasner in Philadelphia, who has refused to prosecute certain low-level felonies and directed his deputies not to seek the maximum punishment in certain cases. There is Wesley Bell, who just won in St. Louis, Missouri, who came in and cleaned house and fired some prosecutors who really weren't standing up for justice. I could go on. There's Rachel Rollins in Suffolk County, Massachusetts. And what these candidates are running on is true reform. They're saying, we don't believe that tough on crime works. We believe in correcting wrongful convictions. We believe in investigating officer-involved shootings. And we don't believe that our office should be another brick in the wall of mass incarceration.
So let me just quote from your article, though, when you give the other side of the picture, if you will. Of course, the full picture is more complicated. During her tenure as district attorney, Ms. Harris refused to seek the death penalty in a case involving the murder of a police officer, and she started a successful program that offered first-time nonviolent offenders a chance to have their charges dismissed if they completed a rigorous vocational training. And as attorney general, she mandated implicit bias training and was awarded for her work in correcting a backlog in the testing of rape kits. So that's on the plus side. So how do you balance this out?
You're right. And it is always important to point out that it's a complicated picture. So it's not just binary. And she does have a record of doing important things. And I think the Back on Track program for first-time nonviolent offenders was very successful and a model for other offices. And it's important to point out where she did important reform-minded things. But for me, on balance, those good deeds are outweighed by the issues that we have talked about. And part of it is because in my book, Rectify, which is about applying restorative justice after wrongful conviction, and also in my work as an innocence attorney, which I did before I came to USF, I saw firsthand the massive catastrophe that is a wrongful conviction and the degree of suffering that it inflicts on people and how common it is and we don't realize it. And to have played a role in that over and over again, to me, is so deeply problematic, in addition to all of the other issues that you and I have talked about, that it outweighs the good.
Well, we know that prisons in this country are absolutely full of African-American men, often very young. And so the idea that Kamala Harris, the child of a Hindu mother and a Black Baptist father, should we expect more empathy towards African-Americans in terms of the judicial system railroading so many of them?
This is a really complicated question, and one prominent feminist writer pointed out that as a South Indian Black woman really trying to forge a path and break barriers, and to be clear, she broke barriers. She was the first Black elected DA and the first Black elected statewide prosecutor in California. There were all of these pressures on her, and actually, you mentioned implicit bias training, but implicit biases and explicit biases geared toward her that other candidates, for example, straight white men, don't routinely face. And so it may have been that she felt in some ways that she had to be tougher in response to that kind of implicit bias and that kind of judgment. To me, that's an explanation. It's not an excuse, but I think it really complicates the question.
Well, just in closing, though, obviously, a lot of Democrats and a lot of Americans, in fact, a majority of Americans, really hate Donald Trump and want him to go away as quickly as possible. And they like Democrats who are in the fight. You know, obviously, Al Franken was one of the best ones in terms of questioning this ridiculous woman that's the Secretary of Education and others. And Sessions himself, he caught Sessions in a lie. But, of course, Gillibrand largely lowered the boom on him. So there aren't too many left that are in there that take on the fight. And she's one of the better ones, Kamala Harris, in terms of questioning. She got Sessions so flummoxed, he said, please, I can't keep up with you. And she was pretty good during the Kavanaugh hearing. So my suspicion is that that's going to carry her a long way, that the Democratic base, they want to fight her.
You may be right. And I want to make clear that if it's a choice between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, I would pull the lever for Kamala Harris. And I expect many, many Democrats would, for the reasons that you said. I do think, though, that two things are important. One, to vet the candidates. And two, to remember that we have at this point a wide open field. And it isn't between Donald Trump and ex-candidate. It's these candidates fighting the good fight on the ground to decide at the end who's going to be the nominee. And we should all be paying close attention to that and making our selections carefully.
Well, Lara Bazelon, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Lara Bazelon, professor of law at the University of San Francisco School of Law and a contributor to Slate and Politico. And she's the author of Rectify, The Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction. And she has an op-ed at the New York Times, Kamala Harris Was Not a Progressive Prosecutor. We're going to take a brief station break, and on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we will look into whether the new conservative majority on the Supreme Court will undo the legacy of Martin Luther King.
Why was he shot down the other day? I'm gonna say he'd seen the mountaintop.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now on this Martin Luther King Jr. holiday is Kristen Clark, President and Executive Director of the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. She formerly spent several years at the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund working on cases defending the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act, and also testified before Congress and state legislatures. She also worked in the U.S. Department of Justice in the Civil Rights Division, serving as a federal prosecutor in the criminal section. And she is the author of Barack Obama and African American Empowerment, The Rise of Black America's New Leadership. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kristen Clark.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Well, thank you, Kristen. And of course, today, in terms of the rise of Black American leadership or new leadership, today Kamala Harris, the junior senator from California, announced her run for the presidency. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, I lead a nonpartisan organization, and so we don't jump into the political fray. But what I can say that it is exciting to see the kind of diversity of individuals who are lining up and vying for the presidency. I think that's a healthy thing for our democracy. And it's also encouraging to see so many people who bring track records that reflect competence and leadership, because that is precisely what our country needs. I will be watching closely from the sidelines how we intend to play a role in this process is doing what we always do with respect to our elections in this country, and that's fighting against voter suppression. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter what electoral contest you're talking about. If we don't have a level playing field that allows all voters' voices to be heard, then democracy is broken. And so one of the things that we are doing for this Martin Luther King holiday is redoubling our efforts to protect the right to vote and to fight against voter suppression, which continues to rear its head in so many communities across the country.
Well, you're being nonpartisan, notwithstanding. Today, Martin Luther King was invoked in a rather partisan way by Vice President Pence, who said that one of my favorite quotes from Dr. King was, "Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. You think of how he changed America. He inspired us to change through the legislative process to become a more perfect union." That's exactly what President Trump is calling on the Congress to do. Come to the table in the spirit of good faith. We'll secure our border. We'll reopen our government. A lot of people are complaining that if Martin Luther King were alive today, he would not be supporting Donald Trump's border wall.
And we know that that's exactly right, because the analogy is the Berlin Wall, which Dr. King spoke out against at every turn. I firmly believe if Dr. King were alive today, he would express outrage and opposition to the idea of erecting a wall. The debate around the wall has emerged in a context that is incredibly racially charged. And it is clear that this is something intended to drive a wedge in our country. I think that it was unfortunate to witness the vice president misappropriate the words of Dr. King today, on this day, a national holiday where we honor and lift up the principles underlying his life's work. And there is nothing that Dr. King has ever done or spoken of in his lifetime that suggests that he would support the wall or many of the divisive policies that we see coming from this administration today.
Well, indeed, President Trump and Vice President Pence did go to the Martin Luther King Memorial in Washington today. They laid a wreath, but they spent all of 2 minutes there. Not exactly enough time to reflect. I mean, some of the inscriptions at that memorial are very moving, particularly the one that says, "Hate cannot conquer hate, only love can do that." And we are in a time and in a country where there's a lot of hate and there's a lot of division. And frankly, a lot of it is being stoked by our president.
That's right. And, you know, we are seeing hate crimes on the rise. We're seeing them on the rise against African Americans, Jewish Americans, immigrant groups, the LGBTQ community. And it's not accidental. It is the direct product of the era that we are in, one where we are seeing policies erected at the federal level that demonize and marginalize minority communities. And I do think that white supremacists who are kind of seeing what this administration is doing, who are listening closely to the rhetoric, feel emboldened. I think that, you know, we fight hate crimes every day at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. One of the cases that we just resolved was against involved an African-American woman elected student president at American University right here inside the nation's capital. On the day that she was elected, the Daily Stormer unleashed a kind of vicious campaign where they issued calls for racist trolls to go out and target her. They doxed her and published her personal information online and made her life miserable. They hung banana peels on campus. They described her as a gorilla. And we filed a lawsuit on her behalf using the public accommodations law here in D.C., which guarantees everyone to equal right and the right to equally enjoy public accommodations, whether it be a hotel restaurant or a college or university. And the facts in this case kind of harken back to the 50s and 60s. It harkens back to the era in which Dr. King was fighting. I think that if he were here with us today, he would be alarmed at how much we have turned the clock back. It's a reminder that while we've made progress, the progress is fragile. And without the right leadership in place, we run the risk on turning the clock back and unraveling all of the hard work that has been done to make our nation more whole.
And again, I'm speaking with Kristen Clark, who's president and executive director of the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. She formerly spent several years at the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, working on cases defending the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act, and also testified before Congress and state legislatures. She also worked at the United States Department of Justice in the Civil Rights Division, serving as a federal prosecutor in the criminal section, and she is the author of Barack Obama and African American Empowerment, The Rise of Black America's New Leadership. Well, when you talk about rolling back the achievements and the inspiration that Martin Luther King provided, particularly to the great civil rights laws, the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the 1965 Voting Rights Act, and the Fair Housing Act of 1968, already the Voting Rights Act has been chipped away at by the Chief Justice John Roberts in his opinion, taking out the preclearance section of that law, which is very important in states with a history of racial discrimination. And the argument there was used essentially was that, oh, this law is outdated. You know, we've moved on. We don't need any more racial entitlements. My sense is that we're going to be hearing a lot more of those arguments with this new conservative majority on the Supreme Court, particularly with the new Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Do you expect there to be an attack on the legacy of MLK through the Supreme Court with going after this 1964 Civil Rights Act, going after the Voting Rights Act even more than they already have done, and the Fair Housing Act of 1968?
The federal civil rights laws that you describe are sacred. We have only a limited number of them. And these were laws passed by Congress in the 60s, and they were the direct result of the hard-fought battles led by peaceful demonstrators and peaceful activists like Dr. King and like Congressman John Lewis, who still bears the scars from being assaulted on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. I think that this is a moment that requires we be on high alert. Our civil rights as Americans, our civil rights laws are most certainly under attack, and we feel it at every turn. The ruling that you referenced, the 2013 ruling issued by the Roberts Court, Shelby County, Alabama versus Holder, cut out the heart of the Voting Rights Act. It brought to a grinding halt a strong provision of that law that required that 16 states with particularly long and egregious histories of voting discrimination obtained federal review of new laws before they could be put into effect. And that prophylactic law really helped to block and deter hundreds of discriminatory voting laws that otherwise would have gone into effect. And literally what we've seen since the Supreme Court issued that ruling is that the floodgates have opened. We saw on the day that the court issued its ruling, Texas moving forward with a discriminatory voter ID law. We saw North Carolina rolling back voting rights in what the Fourth Circuit described as a law executed with, quote, almost surgical precision. We saw it every day in 2018 in Georgia, where under former Secretary of State Brian Kemp, Georgia invoked rules like exact match to erect barriers for people seeking to register to vote. We saw it on the grassroots level in places like Randolph County, where officials tried to eliminate 7 of 9 polling sites in a scheme that would have made it harder for Black voters to cast ballots. What history teaches us and what the present reminds us is that we must remain vigilant in this era. Our civil rights are not secure. The progress made is fragile. And we have to speak up and fight back when we see injustice. And whether that is through the work of civil rights lawyers who are attempting to use the courts to hold the line, or people protesting in the streets, or people turning out at their town hall meetings to hold their officials accountable. This is the spirit that Dr. King required that we approach the problems in our country with, that we approach it with all of our energy and vigor. And in 2019, at every turn, we see reminders of the fact that injustice and discrimination are ingrained into our democracy, and that we have to fight back if we want to keep our democracy intact.
Well, again, at the risk of of embroiling you in partisanship, given this political season and so many candidates running for president, today at a breakfast in Washington, D.C., celebrating Martin Luther King Jr.'s holiday, the former vice president, Joseph Biden, along with the former mayor of New York City, Michael Bloomberg, who's also rumored to be considering a presidential run, Biden said that he'd made a mistake in supporting the tough-on-crime drug legislation in the 1980s and 1990s, and he expressed regret, particularly over a bill that created different legal standards for powdered cocaine and street crack cocaine. So what did you make of that piece of expiation?
Yeah, I was at that breakfast this morning held by the National Action Network. And, you know, what I can say is that we're in an era where the problem of mass incarceration is real. And it is one that is front and center for African Americans and communities of color. We allowed the over-policing of our communities for far too long. We allowed prosecutors to impose harsh sentences for too long at the expense of human lives. I mean, we have destroyed communities. We've destroyed families by locking up people of color for too long for nonviolent low-level offenses. And so whether you're talking about a candidate for the presidency, whether you're talking about a candidate for mayor, a candidate for district attorney, I think that people should expect that communities of color are going to demand answers when it comes to their positions and views on criminal justice. I think people are going to look for officials who will acknowledge and recognize that race infects our criminal justice system. And for officials who have been in office for several decades, they're going to have to reckon with the errors and mistakes that they've made in the past. The war on drugs was a failed experiment. We know now, we knew back then, but everyone should know now that it was a grave error to spend billions of dollars constructing prisons to lock away nonviolent offenders for excessive periods of time. It was somewhat heartening to hear former Vice President Biden concede and admit that some of his views from the past were wrong, to admit that the war on drugs was wrong. And I think that we are going to expect that there will be more communities holding officials accountable, particularly those that have kind of lived through the war on drugs and had a hand in kind of creating the mess that we're now trying to climb out of.
Well, just in closing, do you think that there will be a sort of backlash? You know, the pendulum does swing back and forth to this period of division, and a lot of hatred and a lot of white supremacists have come out of the woodwork feeling that they're emboldened by President Trump. What's your sense of, just in the last 30 seconds or so, whether there might be a kind of healthy backlash, if you will?
To climb out of this mess, we are going to need a strong multiracial movement to speak out against white supremacy and white nationalism at every turn. We're going to need more white Americans who can acknowledge that systemic racism is real. We're going to need more white Americans who can help to hold their fellow white Americans who have given into white supremacist views. We're going to need them to help hold them accountable. We're going to need law enforcement to do their part, and we're going to need national leaders who can speak out about the value of diversity and reject at every turn white supremacy when we see it. Sadly, that's not where we are today, and so we have a lot of work to do.
Well, Kristen Clark, I thank you very much for joining us on this Martin Luther King Jr. holiday.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Kristen Clark, who's the President and Executive Director of the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. She formerly spent several years at the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, working on cases defending the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act, and also testified before Congress and state legislatures. She's also worked at the U.S. Department of Justice in the Civil Rights Division, serving as a federal prosecutor in the criminal section, and she's the author of Barack Obama and African-American Empowerment, The Rise of Black America's New Leadership. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Donald Trump's ongoing record of consistently blocking congressional efforts to sanction Putin.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Alex Whiting, a professor of practice at Harvard Law School, where he teaches, writes, and consults on domestic and international prosecution issues. From 2010 to 2013, he was investigations coordinator at the Office of the Prosecutor at the International Criminal Court in The Hague, and prior to that, was a U.S. federal prosecutor for 10 years, first with the criminal section of the Civil Rights Division in Washington, D.C., and then with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston, where he focused on organized crime and corruption cases. He's also the editor of Just Security. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alex Whiting.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us, Alex. And just to touch on, since you were a prosecutor with the International Criminal Court in The Hague, the ICC got a black eye last week with this former dictator from the Ivory Coast, Gbagbo, who was acquitted. Any thoughts on why that happened? I haven't really looked into it, but I'd be interested to know. It seemed like they dropped the ball.
Well, the judges concluded that there was insufficient evidence to find him culpable for the war crimes and crimes against humanity. But I think that, and there have been a number of both, there have been acquittals, there have been convictions at the International Criminal Court, but a number of acquittals that have raised concerns about the court. And I think there are two things. The first is the prosecutors are trying to figure out what kind of evidence they need to bring and how to manage these cases and do a lot of different cases at once. The court is investigating 10 different countries at the same time right now, and that's hard to manage. So I think the court may have to focus a little more. And the second is it's raising questions about the model of the court, having it spread out over so many different countries, and the prosecutor's strategy to do so many cases at once. And I think what we're going to see is that the court will likely move in a direction to focus on fewer cases and try to bring stronger cases that way.
So let's turn to the big case here in the United States. Well, not that it's really emerged yet, but there's obviously growing anticipation for the Mueller report. Some concerns that William Barr, I spoke with your colleague Andy Wright yesterday, he wrote a piece about His concerns about William Barr, obviously the current acting Attorney General is pretty transparently there to screw things up. It doesn't look like Whitaker has been able to sabotage anything much. Is that your sense?
Yes, it is my sense. And I think that one story here is that despite Trump's attacks on the Mueller investigation, despite his efforts to disrupt it or block it, ultimately, at the end of the day, so far, the norms have held and Mueller has been permitted to do his work and conduct the investigation. And that's partly due to some people at the Justice Department, in particular Rod Rosenstein, partly due to pressure from Congress at certain moments. It's partly due to public commentary and scrutiny. And that's a testament, I think, to our country and institutions and norms. And hopefully they will continue to hold. I tend to believe that we're past the point now where Trump can take the drastic step of firing Mueller. But, of course, there are other ways to curtail and block. For example, if the report never sees the light of day. So I'm not going to say that we're out of the woods, but so far the norms and institutions have held firm.
Well, one of the things that I find extraordinary, though, obviously collusion with Russia or conspiracies, which is probably a more accurate term, hasn't been proven, and Donald Trump reminds us of that constantly. But the president's actions are getting more and more alarming in terms of, for some reason or other, he seems to be really conducting Russia's foreign policy, if you will, instead of America's foreign policy. The extent to which, for example, the latest incident in the Sea of Azov, where the Russians captured patrol boats from Ukraine and are still holding the crews, and then the courts in Russia just extended the hold on these crews. And this has led the Pentagon and the U.S. Congress to want a response, and they asked for a response to support Ukraine and to punish Russia. And Trump has been holding it up. And the NATO countries are looking for leadership because there was a plan to send NATO warships into Ukrainian ports just to sort of show the flag, to let the Russians know that Western Europe was standing behind Ukraine. The U.S. just sent a destroyer into the Black Sea. But in general, Trump has consistently, whether it's sanctions against Russia and against Putin's oligarch's friends, Trump slow walks, backpedals, whatever. He's really working hard not to do what the Congress wants him to do vis-a-vis Russia. So what's going on?
Well, in one way, you could look at Trump's policies towards Russia, his reactions, his actions or lack of actions, his statements as all suggesting that, in fact, Putin does have some kind of hold on him or some control over him. And there are some who have pieced those actions together and drawn that conclusion that Putin does have some kind of control. But I think it's also important to remember that Trump's policies and actions with respect to Russia are in many ways consistent with his broader foreign policy, if you can call it that, in two respects. First of all, he is consistently drawn towards authoritarian leaders and is less supportive and less drawn to democratic allies. So he's very harsh and very hard on the NATO countries and the NATO alliance, for example, but cozies up to Russia and China and North Korea, so forth, and has expressed even envy sometimes of the kinds of powers that those authoritarian leaders have. And then secondly, just the kind of chaos and uninformed policies and reactions and thinking that goes into some of his policies are also consistent with his policies broadly. And so I'm not sure that there's anything distinct or remarkable about his Russia policies. They, in a way, they're of a piece with everything that he does and all his tendencies.
So what I find alarming, Alex, is that the resignation letter by Jim Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, he requested that he stay on until the NATO summit. And Trump apparently didn't even read the resignation letter and then made his own little statement about how great Mattis was. And then when he read the letter, he was furious. And out of a sort of childish fit of pique, he refused to allow Mattis to stay on till the NATO summit and fired him on the spot so that he could look like he's in charge. So apparently, according to New York Times reports, Trump was within minutes of going to the microphone and announcing that the U.S. was pulling out of NATO, and he was stopped by Mattis. Apparently, Bolton doesn't seem to have much influence, and neither does Pompeo. What's going on with Pompeo, for the life of me, I don't understand why he's so sycophantic and why there's nobody around, no adults left now. So what do you think's going to happen here? If he's come that close to making such an extraordinary step, and he can do it, he's the commander-in-chief, do you think that a huge shoe is going to drop soon?
Well, I think Trump has done certain drastic things. For example, on the Paris Climate Accord, I think on NAFTA that was in many ways drastic. But then there have been other drastic things that he has hinted at or threatened. For example, firing Mueller, ending that investigation, or to tie back to our prior conversation, or pulling out of NATO. That I think are a bridge too far. I think if he did either of those things, there would be mass revolt within the Republican Party in Congress, and I think it would be untenable, unsustainable. I just cannot imagine that he could pull the United States out of NATO and not lose massive support among senators in the Republican Party, and that would be difficult for him now, because now that the House is in Democratic hands, he needs the protection of the Senate. He needs that cover, and I just can't imagine that happening. But of course, these last 2 years have been about a lot of things that we never imagined would happen. So we can't rule it out. But as I said, even accepting that Trump's election was drastic and he's done many drastic things, pulling out of NATO is in a completely different category that would radically upset the political balance and political understandings. And I don't see it happening.
So what did you make of Governor Christie's remark that Trump's staff, the people that surround him, are not helping him? He's surrounded by a bunch of riffraff, to quote Governor Christie, who was up to be either the Attorney General, the Secretary of State, or even the Vice President. So one of the things that's extraordinary, just to stay with the foreign policy issue here, apparently Bolton said something in Israel that really infuriated Erdogan, the Turkish dictator. And Trump had to send Lindsey Graham over to smooth things over. So it does seem in a curious way that none of these cabinet members are necessarily in charge, are they? I mean, maybe it's impossible with Trump himself,
Yeah, I think that's the point. I think that's exactly the point, what you just said. It's true, of course, that there are some of the members of cabinet, some who have come and gone, some who are still in place, are less than stellar, may even be described as riffraff or whatever term Christie used. But I think the bigger story is not that. The bigger story, and the more important story, which Christie should focus on, is Trump's leadership and how he manages the cabinet. And what's clear is that despite selling himself as a businessman who could run Washington and run the White House and the executive better than anybody else, and who could make deals better than anybody else, he's none of those things. And his style of complete chaos maybe works in business, though I think the record shows otherwise, but at least the consequences are more limited. But it certainly doesn't work in Washington. And I think what we're seeing here is that nobody is in charge, and there's fighting and there's chaos and there's lack of clarity on what the government's policies are. And we see this with respect to the shutdown, with respect to policy vis-a-vis North Korea, NATO, as you said, all over on all major policies, there's complete uncertainty and chaos and lack of any kind of credibility. So I think that's the story here.
Well, at the end of the month, he's going to have another one of those totally fatuous meetings with Kim Jong-un, another photo op. The last one yielded nothing except a photo op. And he's insisting on telling us that things are going great, and he got a beautiful letter from Kim Jong-un. Has anybody in that White House pointed out how sort of unpleasant this whole thing is? Here we are, the United States, supposed to be the bulwark of global democracy, our leader praising probably the worst despot on the planet. I mean, there's some pretty bad people doing horrible things to their own people. But I think in many ways Kim Jong-un is one of the cruelest.
Right. That's certainly true. And Trump, we now know what kind of a person he is and where his values lie and who he admires and who he fails to respect. And of course, the people who are around him have survived around him because they're sycophants, and they're either unwilling or unable to tell him. But what continues to baffle me is how members of the Republican Party, leading members, including leading senators, can stand this and can put up with it without criticizing him, without openly abandoning him on these stands. The Republican Party used to stand for real integrity and kind of professionalism and expertise in foreign policy. And they are standing by silently or even supporting the president when he is bringing complete chaos to foreign policy. And as you say, when he's cozying up to dictators around the world, whether it's Putin or Kim Jong-un. And that I think is extraordinary that their complicity in that, and the fact that they have made a political calculation that it's better to stay silent or support Trump because they get their judicial nominees or they're in power or whatever it is, it's just really, I think, extraordinary.
Well, it's just to close, since you worked in the criminal section of the Civil Rights Division in the Justice Department, what did you make of Trump's visit to the MLK Memorial in Washington, D.C. today, where he spent all of 2 minutes?
Well, it's no surprise. It's in keeping with how he's approached issues of race in our country. And he has looked for every opportunity to divide us more on those issues, to undermine any kind of discussion or progress we might make in those areas. And so I'm disappointed, but I'm not particularly surprised.
Well, Iris Whiting, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Alex Whiting, who's a professor of practice at Harvard Law School, where he teaches rights and consults on domestic and international criminal prosecution issues from 2010 until 2013. He was investigations coordinator of the Office of the Prosecutor of the International Criminal Court in The Hague, and prior to that was a U.S. federal prosecutor for 10 years, first with the criminal section of the Civil Rights Division in the DOJ in Washington, and then with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston, where he focused on organized crime and corruption. corruption cases, and he's also the editor of Just Security. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.